Chapter 15. Owen. Glowing green lights brighten as the demons approach, causing the encampment to shift into an uproar. Children weep and mothers console them as people rush about, a large crowd gathering on the edge of the tents as if to await the demons to fall upon them. My ranger instincts kick in immediately and I move into a protective stance beside Zara, brandishing my quill dagger.
"Put that thing away!"
Zara hisses, pulling away as I try to grab her arm.
"You're going to scare them."
"Scare them?" I ask, incredulous. "In case you haven't noticed, an army of demons is bearing down on us as we speak." She heaves a sigh and points.
"Try to look beyond your own nose for once. These people aren't preparing to fight. They're preparing offerings to give their masters. See?"
I blink, looking in the direction she's pointing. Sure enough, wicker baskets are being brought forward and laid out on the edge of the camp. These baskets are filled with a wide variety of things, including coarse woven fabrics, odd-looking vegetables, and heaps of grain. Curiously, there seems to be one offering that is much more prevalent than the others: metal. Baskets upon baskets of iron ore and glittering minerals are placed out in front of the crowd, the sheer weight of them forcing as many as 3 or 4 slaves to help carry a single basket.
"That must be why they're gathering rocks in the hills," I realize grudgingly, putting away my weapon. "They're trying to find metal to give to the demons as a gift."
The shaggy-haired youth and his father return to our side, looking suddenly very worried. The older man shouts something and points, his voice sounding sharp and not the least bit friendly. The youth nods obediently and hands the two of us a pair of thick, brown blankets, explaining something in a hurried tone. We accept them, and I glance over at Zara, giving her a confused look.
"I think they want us to conceal ourselves with these blankets," she suggests, unfolding one and pulling it over her head like a shawl. "We don't exactly blend in the way we're dressed."
Grunting, I follow her lead, wrapping the itchy fabric around my shoulders in an attempt to cover my ranger's cloak and leathers. Once disguised, the youth gives us an encouraging nod. His father, on the other hand, mutters something under his breath and stomps off, going to join the rest of the people gathering on the plains. Following, we make our way to the back of the crowd, shuffling into the mass of bodies and attempting to appear inconspicuous. Many around us give us frightened looks, but nobody objects to our presence. They're too afraid of what's coming. Slowly, the R'lar come into view, their otherworldly light casting long shadows as they march. They move in a long column flanked by snarling darkhounds and other creatures that I've never seen before. These new beasts are tall and lanky, with pale skin stretched over sinewy limbs. The bulk of the force seems to be made up of gorgons, many of which are holding balls of demon fire in their hands, the way men might carry torches. In total, there are about 50 demons, and all of them are armed and armored. The procession comes to a halt, and everyone in the crowd of slaves drops to their knees, bowing low until their foreheads are touching the ground. Zara and I quickly follow suit, trying to blend in with everyone else. Something tells me that if we're discovered, the demons will be none too pleased.
"They'd probably kill us and anyone who harbored us, if we're lucky."
They approach the wicker baskets, no one on either side uttering so much as a single word. Stealing a glance at the demons, I can see a figure making its way to the front, a gorgon in elaborate black and red armor.
"Must be some sort of captain," I determine, dropping my head back down.
The demon proclaims something in the language of the slaves, its gravelly voice carrying over the large crowd of humans. Many of the creatures surrounding it snicker and converse quietly in their own guttural tongue. The captain continues with its speech, striding up to one of the baskets and peering inside. Several of the other gorgons advance as well, letting their fires evaporate as they examine the contents of the baskets. They jostle each other and laugh as if this is all some grand joke. The one in the lead picks up a fistful of grain and sniffs it, then snorts and drops it to the dirt. No one in the crowd moves or speaks, the terror in the air palpable. Eventually, the captain motions for the baskets to be taken, and more of the gorgons step forward to pick them up. They seem to take special care with the offerings of ore, but don't seem the least bit encumbered by the weight. Once all the baskets are carried away and the demons fall back in line,
The captain walks up to the edge of the crowd and with smoldering eyes examines the faces of the people. I tense, and my mind goes to Zara. If they find us, what are we going to do? What can we do? Would I have time to save her? Even though fighting would likely be futile against so many, my hand still strays to my belt where the quill dagger is hidden. The captain makes its way slowly through the crowd, people whimpering and cringing as it walks close to them. The Gorgon seems to be searching for something, a wicked sneer adorning its grotesque, mottled face, as it examines the cowering slaves. It stops 10 paces away from the two of us and rests a hand on the hilt of the curved sword on its belt. Then, raising a black-nailed finger, the demon points to someone kneeling before it while growling words I don't understand. A woman cries out in alarm, a heart-wrenching scream of terror. Daring a peek, I crane my neck to see a pretty young girl getting hauled to her feet. She looks to be only a few years younger than Zara, and in her eyes I can see the fear that accompanies someone who knows they're about to die. A man beside her jumps to his feet and throws his arms around her protectively. He cries out pleadingly, his voice full of emotion. In a flash, the Gorgon draws its sword and reaches forward to grasp the man around his neck. It lifts the man into the air, causing him to flail wildly in a vain attempt to escape, then rams its sword into his stomach, twisting cruelly and spilling the slave's blood into the dirt. The girl wails, saying the words, "Bobby! Bobby!" over and over as the demon drops the man's limp form to the ground. Then, sheathing its sword, the demon grabs her by the hair and drags her away. I clench my fist in anger, watching the girl sobbing uncontrollably. "Why is no one resisting?" I think furiously. "These people outnumber the demons 5 to 1. Nobody moves or speaks as the Gorgon returns to the column of demons, the only sound being the girl's cries as she's led away. As quickly as they arrived, the demons return to the desert, their green flames lighting the darkness as they depart with their spoils. The sobs grow fainter and fainter until they disappear, the demon fire fading to nothing but a distant light on the horizon. Even now, nobody dares to move. It isn't until they're fully out of sight that the crowd shuffles to its feet, muttering wearily as they begin making their way back to their tents. A few people, presumably family and friends, weep softly over the body of the fallen man, closing his eyes and mournfully carrying him away. "What in the 11 hells was that all about?" I ask, looking to Zara.
"I'm not sure,"
she replies, taking my hand and squeezing hard. Her face is as pale as milk in the starlight. "But I think I'm beginning to understand why these people are the way they are." "They're cowards," I respond, still enraged that no one stood up to the demons.
"No,"
she replies, pulling her blanket more tightly around her shoulders with her free hand.
"No, I don't think they're cowards. They've been slaves for more than 1,000 years. They've probably been beaten down so many times by the R'hllar that no one dares to fight back. This is all they know."
"Still," I say stubbornly, "they could have done something to save that girl. What did they want with her anyway?"
"I don't know."
She shivers visibly. The shaggy-haired youth leads us silently back to the camp, weaving between the tents without saying a word. He, more than anyone else, looks angry at what has transpired, his discontent showing plainly by the furrow in his brow and the dark look in his eyes. He brings us to an empty tent and gestures for us to go inside, saying something in a low voice. We enter at his behest, and Zara thanks him before closing the flap behind us. And now, we are finally alone.